Speak up.
You're listening to Speak Up on CJSF 90.1 FM Burnaby. We're the campus and community radio station at Simon Fraser University, where we broadcast from unceded Coast Salish territories.
Good morning, everyone. This is Danny Nesvedarani, your host for this hour of Speak Up, only on CJSF 90.1 FM. It is Tuesday, August 11th at 10 a.m. Before we get started with today's episode, I just want to acknowledge that this program, as well as all of our programs here at CJSF, are broadcasted on the unceded and ancestral lands of the Hulkamilam and Squamish-speaking peoples who have been here on these lands since time immemorial. Now, there's a lot going on in the province of BC, and we will be getting to just a fraction of that this hour before we get into the talk and interview portion of this hour, though. Let's start off this morning, wherever you are right now, whether you're in your car, driving to work, whether you're at home, whether you're working. Let's start off with some music. This is Stanley Park Ravers by the Golden Age of Wrestling, of their latest album, Sweet Chin Music. Hope you enjoy. Thank you. Once again, that was the Golden Age of Wrestling with Stanley Park Ravers. Hopefully that was a nice way to start your morning off. And to get on with the rest of this hour, we're going to be talking about something that is plaguing a lot of BC. And even if for a lot of people in the Lower Mainland right now, it might be a little bit of out of sight, out of mind, this is still an ongoing issue, and that is the current wildfires roaming throughout BC. The BC Wildfire Service recently announced they anticipate more lightning caused fires to start in the days ahead. At the moment, more than 21,400 people are under evacuation order and 11,000 under evacuation alert. In about 1 hour at 11 a.m. Pacific time, the province will be providing its own wildfire update. But until then, here is some information regarding what is currently going on. The Canadian military is also currently on standby, and there are 100 firefighters from Mexico that are set to arrive soon. There are currently no timelines in place for the Summerland residents that have had to evacuate due to the Bald Range wildfire, which has now burned up to 156 square kilometers as of today. Unfortunately, Penticton RCMP have confirmed that at least one person has passed away as a result of the fire. Police say it was a 80-year-old woman who died suddenly while trying to flee the fire with her family. The sheer scale of the damage to Summerland and surrounding areas is still not something that is fully known, and it is something that most likely will be determined within the coming days. but there is also still growth of wildfires in other areas. Growth is expected on Brunswick Complex, the Ainslie Creek wildfire, one of two that make up the Brunswick Complex near Boston Bar, and it continues to grow along its northeast and southeast corners, reaching up to 541 square kilometers as of now. Due to the current weather as well, the Wildfire Service is warning that there is a high potential for new fires to start as a result of dry lightning in the central interior and Okanagan. So this is something that is still ongoing. We will see where the province is at with their update at 11 a.m., but until then, that is what is currently happening with wildfires in BC. This is obviously something that is being reported on province-wide, not just by the BC Wildfire Service, but essentially any publication that is wanting to inform their listeners of what is going on in their home province. Certain publications, such as those funded by the Local Journalism Initiative, including CJLY in Nelson, BC. They recently had a report just a few days back on the air quality warnings that are currently plaguing the Kootenays and Boundary.
Now burning in many parts of the province, air quality warnings are currently in effect for most of the southern regions of British Columbia, including the West Kootenays and the Boundary. Morgan Scholl, a meteorologist with Environment Canada, says most of the smoke in our region is coming from the large wildfire complexes to the west. These include the Brunswick Creek Complex in the Fraser Canyon, the Deer Lake wildfires near Clinton, and the Bradley Creek fires near Vernon. Scholl says the current weather conditions are bringing smoke to the Kootenays that is likely to stay a while.
Right now, the weather pattern has switched to a westerly flow. So all of that smoke has headed into your area. And unfortunately, going into the weekend, we're going to continue to see that westerly push. Saturday into Sunday, it looks like there could be some instability as well. So there's kind of like an upper level trough moving in, which means more potential for atmospheric mixing. So there might be a slight reprieve periodically, but we're still predominantly getting that westerly flow into your region, bringing that smoke into you guys.
Due to fires in the state of Washington to the south, even if the weather pattern changes, it is unlikely to offer much relief.
Obviously, there's fires kind of surrounding you guys, yeah, which is a problem, because then even if the flow switches to southerly flow, well, then you're going to start bringing up the smoke from south of the border as well. With the upper level instability going through the region. It looks like there could be a few slight showers kind of to the west of you guys, north and west of you guys. But then also just a reminder that especially Saturday at the moment, we're also looking at the potential for more thunderstorms, which that could trigger more fires. So it's not the best news, obviously.
Scholl notes that it's important to heed the guidelines with air quality advisories. These include postponing or reducing strenuous outdoor activities until the warning has ended and spending time indoors in a space with cleaner air.
If you're going to plan any highly exertive activities, you know, try to aim for the treadmill or postpone your training at least into the next week until this heavy, heavy smoke lifts.
Yeah.
And maybe checking in vulnerable family and friends who might be impacted by poor air quality.
Some people are more likely to be negatively impacted by smoke. This includes people with lung and heart conditions, pregnant individuals, infants and young children, people aged 65 and older, and anyone whose health is affected by a chronic condition or acute illness. For Kootenai Co-op Radio News and the Local Journalism Initiative, I'm Jamie Frederick. With wildfires now burning in many parts.
We are back with Speak Up, only on CJSF 90.1 FM. This is your host for the hour, Danny Nezvedarani. Thank you to Jamie Frederick and CJLY in Nelson, BC for that quick little report. Here at CJSF, I recently interviewed James Whitehead of the Mitigating Wildfire Initiative, which is based here at Simon Fraser University. A bit of a long-form interview, and one that if you tuned in to Speak Up yesterday morning with Magnus, you most likely heard. But I think it is a pretty important one, especially when there is just so much rapid-fire information regarding the current destruction of the wildfires happening here in BC, to learn of the people and individuals working to making this province more habitable and introducing new ways of addressing wildfires. So I think it's an important interview and one that I'm going to play once more for all of you right now. So take a listen to my interview with James Whitehead of the Mitigating Wildfire Initiative. Reporting from Burnaby, BC, this is Danny Nezvedarani, your community journalist for CJSF 90.1 FM. At Simon Fraser University's Morris J. Wask Center for Dialogue, the Mitigating Wildfire Initiative is putting preventative measures, indigenous stewardship, and community partnerships at the forefront of wildfire mitigation. From creating partnerships with communities most impacted by wildfire, to even creating resources on how to effectively communicate on wildfires, the initiative wants to make clear that there are numerous approaches to help address BC's yearly wildfire season. To learn more about some of these approaches, we sat down for a conversation with the initiative's special projects manager, James Whitehead. During the interview, we spoke about some of the work of the Mitigating Wildfire Initiative and some of the common misconceptions surrounding how wildfires are perceived and dealt with. Please take a listen.
We tend to use the tools of dialogue, facilitation, and engagement to really try and address some of the complexities around wildfire management and mitigation in BC. So my role specifically within the organization is figuring out this messy intersection between wildfire and forest management. So how our forest sector plays into the challenge of wildfires and how they can be part of the solution. But on top of that, we also do work looking at cultural burning, indigenous fire stewardship, rural evacuation reluctance, and a lot of other factors that kind of all link into this really complex question of wildfire in BC.
When was the initiative first formed? When was it decided that something like this was as necessary as it was?
Yeah, so the initiative was formed, I believe, close to 4 years ago now, kind of the brainchild of Robin Prest, who's one of the directors at the Center for Dialogue, and then Yolanda Clatworthy, who's the director of this program. And then I came in as a second employee about 8 months later, so I've been here just over 3 years now.
From being a part of the Mitigating Wildfires Initiative, what are some of the core solutions that the people involved with the initiative, including yourself, have, I guess, come to when it comes to addressing wildfires as we are now experiencing them pretty much every summer?
Yeah, so this is a really disappointing answer, but fires are really a frustrating thing where there aren't necessarily clean solutions. So fundamentally, throughout most of British Columbia and most of Canada, We do live in fire-prone forests, so these are forests that ecologically are designed to burn on a regular basis. Some are designed to burn at a low intensity every 10 to 15 years, and some are designed to burn in a catastrophic, extreme manner once every 100, 200 years. And so fundamentally, when we consider what we're doing with wildfire, we have to recognize that these are still forests that do need to burn and we expect to burn. With that being said, we've also deprived these forests of fire for 100 plus years. So these forests have 100 years of buildup that naturally would have burnt off on a much more regular basis. And so they're quite departed from what the healthy natural forest might have looked like. And that was through lightning fires. That was often through cultural burning from First Nations people. And what we're seeing now is that coupled with climate change is leading to these really catastrophic fires, and coupled with the expansion of communities out into more rural areas, we're seeing that those more catastrophic fires really interact negatively with communities. So when it comes to solutions, those solutions have to recognize those fundamental factors and not simply be suppression focused, i.e., trying to stop fires quicker and quicker and quicker, because that's essentially the same logic that's got us into this situation. What we do need to really focus on is to think about that ecosystem restoration, how we restore some of those ecosystems to a more healthy state. So up in the northern forests, this probably is less relevant, but in the southern and interior forests that we see throughout much of BC, those forests are meant to be very wide open. I've heard people describe it as you could ride a horse through them. And that's not the forest we see today. So that's generally looks like more thinning, so clearing out some of the smaller trees. So it's not logging where we're taking the big valuable trees that are most marketable. It's taking the smaller, less valuable trees, and thinning those ecosystems out a little bit. It's also burning more in those ecosystems. So they are fire-dependent forests. We need to restore those natural fire cycles. And then on top of that, it looks like just living with fire. So an expectation within populations that live through most of interior BC that fire is a healthy and natural and manageable part of the ecosystem, and that people need to be prepared for that. So the unfortunate reality of living in BC is smoke will be a factor in our life, and at to a point we can try and stop it, but we also really need to focus on how we live with this hazard as people. And so that's really preparing our homes, our communities, our properties.
Earlier, you mentioned this idea that the very aggressive wildfires are due to decades of buildup in which there were no fires. Can you explain that a bit more? What that, I guess, is in reference to?
Yeah, so that's not to say that there weren't huge fires in the past. There absolutely were. But what we've seen is throughout much of interior BC, these are forests that were designed to burn every 5 to 50 years, depending on where you are. As we've stopped those fires from happening, more and more trees have built up. So those fires naturally would have killed a lot of the smaller trees and vegetation and brush. And so as we've stopped those fires, we've got really, really good at putting out small fires. Those forests have been allowed to become denser and denser and denser, and in some places they're 10 times as dense as they used to be, meaning that they look very different. And when a fire comes through now, it's going to essentially kill everything. It's so much more fuel in the landscape for those fires to burn. And so when it's thinned out, that's not to say that the fires won't burn, but they'll burn at a much smaller, like much lower intensity, at a smaller scale, and be much more manageable and controllable. So there's photos of Jasper from the 1920s versus when it burnt just last 2 years ago. And the difference in the landscape is absolutely massive. We're used to have these patchworks of forests in different places, these big openings, the forests that you did see have holes in them and thinned areas. And now we just see this carpet of green across the landscape. And so that increase in vegetation is really the challenge right now, as we're dealing with so much fuel in the landscape that never was there before.
And that's, I guess, part of the factors, or that is a factor in there being a such a stark increase in wildfires within recent years throughout BC.
Yeah, absolutely. So one stat that surprises a lot of people is we're not actually seeing more fires in BC than we have before. What we're starting to see is bigger fires and more catastrophic fires. And really, this ties into the focus shouldn't be necessarily as much on what starts the fire. The focus is why these fires are spreading. And what we've done is kind of created the perfect conditions for these fires to spread by, I mean, not necessarily adding fuel to the fire in most cases, but we've simply not not remove fuel from the fire for a century, and then we warm the climate, and then we put more humans in that situation. It's really the perfect storm. So, fundamentally, that just goes back to the recognition that most of BC is in a fire-prone ecosystem. It is an area that needs to burn, and we have to live with that reality.
You had mentioned the initiative also working with Indigenous communities and partners. Can you speak on that? Some of the partners that the initiative has been working with and their contributions to the work?
Yeah, so when it comes to Indigenous communities, there's been a huge resurgence in interest on something known as cultural burning. And so cultural burning can be used for community protection, but cultural burning also really recognizes the importance of fire in restoring cultural values. So sometimes that's medicines and plants that really respond well to burning. Sometimes that's supporting mammals and ungulates. And sometimes those are spiritual or other cultural values that that are maybe less apparent to us from the outside. And this restoration of cultural burning has really been kind of one of the biggest, most positive signs we've seen in recent years, where a lot of nations are kind of taking this into their own hands and leading the charge. And so we've seen a lot of great examples of cultural burning happening. And there's organizations like First Nations Emergency Services who provide a lot of the infrastructure and framework. And then on top of that, we have groups like First Nations Forestry Council and a lot of independent nations and bands that have expressed support or interest in doing this. So our role in this has largely been in a support role. So we've my colleague Yolanda convened a workshop a while back with a bunch of Indigenous youth and on a canoe trip, so all off on the land, and worked with elders to go and provide some of the lessons that those elders had learned burning their whole lives in some case, to really try and create help build that next generation of young fire keepers. We've also helped with supporting Indigenous-only conversations around fire stewardship. So a lot of the time we see cultural burning as an add-on to prescribed burning. So we will talk about prescribed burning, and then First Nations are also doing this work. So it's prescribed and cultural burning. But that doesn't necessarily reflect the additional complexities that nations are facing in doing this work. And so Yolanda has really been there to, in some cases, just provide the space, provide the venue for those conversations that are maybe are happening in a sort of in community to community or nation to nation way. And so they aren't just sort of shoehorned or added as an add-in to a broader conversation about burning.
Yeah, it's I guess incorporating a perspective that maybe hasn't been as incorporated in past mitigation initiatives, especially like in academia and stuff like that. So it was interesting to see that specific perspective championed in the way that it was through this.
Yeah, and we're starting to see, and this is I think one of the most promising or interesting signs of progress is the absolutely rapid expansion of interest in cultural burning and real efforts to address some of the legal and liability barriers around it. There's still a huge amount of work to do, and it's by no means happened at the scale anyone wanted to, but the change in the last even 3 years since I've been involved with this project has been pretty remarkable to see.
This next question I have is a little bit self-serving, but I noticed that there was the toolkit regarding wildfire communication for journalists. Can you tell me a bit about that? What were the gaps, I suppose, in wildfire communication that you felt needed to be addressed?
Yeah, so this workshop came about due to a few reasons. One is we see adversarial situations where between journalists and fire agencies very routinely. And it's something that kind of you might not be as familiar from on the outside, where you just sort of see a news report. But there's a lot of complexities as to how to report around wildfire. And there's a couple key points that have come up over and over again. The first is the question of access. In an active emergency zone or disaster area, how much access should journalists get if it takes crews away from their job to make sure journalists are safe or in the right area? How much should we prioritize that? The second is, how do we tell a story around fire if someone is sleeping in their cars after being evacuated from a wildfire? Is that a failure on governments? Do we talk about that in the right way? Like often it's presented as this big failure, but these are are emergencies. We can foresee them happening, but we don't know where and when and how they're going to happen. And then finally, how can we tell the story of fire in a more positive or more collaborative way, not simply as fire is this enemy that is coming for your home, your livelihood, your property, but how can we tell the story of fire as a natural part of the ecosystem? How can we tell the story of the cultural values of fire that we see in so many indigenous communities across the province? And so there's this really, I think, complex state of telling the story around fire, and we really wanted to kind of dig into that a little bit. So for me personally, one of the inspirations was seeing a headline around a fire near a community, and the fire went from 4 to 16 hectares overnight, and two homes have been put on evacuation alert, not order. So just highlighting that there may potentially be a risk to the home. And the headline on a major newspaper was "Man-made inferno quadruples in size overnight, threatens homes." And nothing is objectively incorrect about that, but it's creating a very misleading kind of panic-driven narrative. And so what we did was we put had a workshop in Sun Peaks, and we had, I believe it was about 20 to 25 journalists and 20 to 25 fire experts, ranging from smoke researchers to operations people within the wildfire service to cultural burning experts to foresters, and basically had this conversation around what is the story we need to tell around wildfire. And so two areas where that really came up were the access question. What does access look like for journalists on a fire? Should any journalist be able to come and get unlimited access? Should there be mandatory training? That sort of thing. That was a little more unresolved because that's frankly outside our wheelhouse to really lead that conversation. But then the second was, how do we tell the story of fire? And what does responsible journalism look like? And so can we tell the story of fire throughout the winter and the spring and the fall to highlight what people can be doing to prepare? How can we report day of? And so that's really I think the piece that came up is just that overall narrative around fire, because some journalists do a great job, but there's a lot of really poor, I think, kind of sensational.